Welcome to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. Today we're in for a treat. You're going to hear a poetry reading by the poet X.J. Kennedy. I was fortunate enough to hear a part of this reading yesterday at the Suwannee Writers Conference. And Mr. Kennedy has published 6 previous collections of poetry, including New Descending a Staircase, which was the winner of the 1961 Academy of American Poets Lamont Prize, Cross Ties, winner of the 1985 Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and Dark Horses, published by Johns Hopkins in 1992. He has written 18 children's books and several textbooks, including An Introduction to Poetry with Dana Gioia, now in its 10th edition. His numerous honors include the Aiken Taylor Award for Lifetime Achievement in Modern American Poetry, the Guggenheim and National Arts Council Fellowships, and the Shelley Memorial Award. Mr. Kennedy lives with his wife, Dorothy, in Lexington, Massachusetts, and part of what he will be reading from today is The Lords of Misrule, a collection of his poems from 1992 through 2001, which is published by Johns Hopkins Press, and you have information on this book and the others on the website. So first of all, good morning, Mr. Kennedy, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Casey. It's a great pleasure to be here on your show. And I'll start by reading a poem that's very new. It's coming out in a little magazine called Fulcrum, and it tells about a terrible fear I've got. I think we all have our personal traumas, and this one is my fear of taking a car into the car wash to have it cleaned up. It seems to me that when you take a car into a car wash, it's as if you're going back to the womb. And while some think the womb is a pleasant place where you swim in your private swimming pool, taking tenderloin steak through a hose, it seems to me that there's something terrible about being unborn. Here you are, drifting in the dark. You don't know what these mysterious sounds are that you hear from outside, and you fear that sometime you're going to have to go out of your comfortable little cocoon and enter the world. So this is called Panic in the Car Wash. In neutral, hunched down, worried at the wheel, I'm trundled through a claustrophobic cave of swatting fingers, brushes, gushes, thrown back to the womb, suspended on a chain, helpless, while hands perfect me in the dark. Christ, let me out! Release me! Get me born with eyes unfinished, anything to see this waterfall of wax drip to a stop, these obstetricians halt. Bring on that sweet green light at uterus's end. Roll me into the sunlight. Whack my back. I'd like to read you something old from the beginning of my career as a poet, if that's what you call me, back about 1903. No, I had a first book in 1961, and this poem was in it. It's a memory of a Catholic boyhood called First Confession. I was the child of what they then called a mixed marriage. My father was Catholic, my mother was Methodist, and when I got to adolescence, they sort of canceled each other out. But I made my first confession and Holy Communion at our parish church in Dover, New Jersey, when I was belatedly about 12 years old. And I have to tell you that we had a priest who was a ferocious looking old fellow, Father Mahoney. He had had some sort of liver trouble, so all his hair had fallen out, leaving the top of his bald dome cratered and pockmarked like the surface of the moon. And when you knelt in the dim confession booth to tell all the dirty little secrets that you had saved up all your life so far, you saw Father Mahoney's bald head coming down like some enormous menacing planet to hear your dirty little secrets. So I made my confession, and then the next day received Holy Communion. First confession. Blood thudded in my ears. I scuffed, stepped stubborn to the telltale booth, beyond whose curtained portal coughed the robed repositor of truth. Oh, let me just stop for a second here to explain that the robed repositor of truth, that's a highfalutin way of saying the priest. If this is an old poem, as I say, if I were writing it now, I wouldn't say the robed repositor of truth. I would just say the priest. But anyway, he opens the slat of his confessional. The slat shot back. The universe bowed down his crater dome to hear enumerated my each curse. The sip snitched from my old man's beer. My sloth, pride, envy, lechery, the dime held back from Peter's pence, with which I'd bribed my girl to pee, that I might spy her instruments. Hovering scale pans, when I'd done, settled their balance, slow as silt, while in the restless dark I burned, bright as a brimstone in my guilt, until, as one feeds birds, he doled seven Our Fathers and a hail, which I, to double scrub my soul, intoned twice at the altar rail, where Sunday, in seraphic light, I knelt as full of grace as most, and stuck my tongue out at the priest, a fresh roost for the Holy Ghost. Let me read you another venerable poem with whiskers on it, but I hope not mold. It is called Nude Descending a Staircase, which was the title of my first book. The book has been reprinted in an ugly-looking edition by Carnegie Mellon University Press. Anyway, you may recognize the title, Nude Descending a Staircase, as that of a famous painting by Marcel Duchamp, the French cubist who caused a sensation at the Armory Art Show of 1919 when he exhibited this painting of a nude figure descending, looking like many frames of an animated cartoon all superimposed at once. He was representing motion. Well, I don't think a poem can do a very good job of catching everything that you'd find in a work of art. I simply thought that Duchamp had hit upon a lovely subject which might make a poem. I was encouraged by something T.S. Eliot said once, that immature poets imitate, mature poets outright steal. Nude descending a staircase. Toe upon toe, a snowing flesh, a gold of lemon, root and rind. She sifts in sunlight down the stairs, with nothing on, nor on her mind. We spy beneath the banister a constant thresh of thigh on thigh. Her lips imprint the swinging air that parts to let her parts go by. One woman waterfall, she wears her slow descent like a long cape, and pausing on the final stair, collects her motions into shape. Let me offer you one other, a very brief poem that goes back a long time. It's called Little Elegy for a Child Who Skipped Rope. Now, people have asked me, was there an actual little girl who skipped rope and died, and you wrote this about her? No, there wasn't. I think this poem originated in the influences of some earlier poets whom I had read and admired. Robert Herrick in the 17th century has a beautiful small elegy for a child that begins, "Here she lies, a pretty bud, lately made of flesh and blood." And Ben Jonson wrote a touching, moving elegy for his first son, whom he called his best piece of poetry. Little elegy for a child who skipped rope. "Here lies resting, out of breath, out of turns, Elizabeth, whose quicksilver toes not quite cleared the whirring edge of night. Earth, whose circles round us skim, till they catch the lightest limb. Shelter now, Elizabeth, and for her sake, trip up death." Let me read you some things from a new collection, my last book. Well, I hope it's not my last. The Lords of Misrule, from Johns Hopkins University Press, who are going to do a new and selected poems, I think in the spring of 2007. Oh, heck, I can wait. This is an elegy for Allen Ginsberg. I did not know Allen Ginsberg well. I didn't know him at all. We exchanged maybe a couple of business postcards. I once heard him read, chanting as he used to do. And I thought Ginsberg a valuable person. I thought he wrote too much. And not all of his poetry hit me. Although I admire the poem that made him famous, Howl, especially the first part with the crazy surrealistic humor. The end of it, it seems to me that Ginsberg didn't know how to end it, so he blames all the ills of America on Moloch, the god of money. And I think that's forced. But Ginsberg wrote some lovely shorter poems, too. In a supermarket in California, and one thing another. So anyway, when Ginsberg died, I was strangely touched, because I had always felt, in a funny way, a kinship to the man. We had both grown up in industrial suburban towns in northern New Jersey. He in Passaic, I guess, and I was in Dover, and we had both gone to Columbia. I went there only for a master's. We both had the good fortune to have Lionel Trilling for a teacher. We both had fathers who wrote rather sentimental poetry. Allen Ginsberg's father, Louis Ginsberg, wrote copiously. I know when I was poetry editor for the Paris Review, every other day brought a fat envelope full of poems from Louis Ginsberg, and most of them were terrible. But like most editors that old Louis had bombarded, I finally got worn down and took something that seemed better than the ordinary run of his stuff. But anyway, Ginsberg also, as I am, was immensely fond of the songs of William Blake. Ginsberg once recorded some of Blake's songs of innocence and experience on an old LP that, where he had some of his beat friends shaking cymbals and bashing gongs and whatnot. And it's really, really rather good. Anyhow, when Ginsberg died, I felt touched. I thought he would be missed. He was a presence that if he hadn't been invented, it would have been necessary to invent him. So this is for Allen Ginsberg, with an echo of William Blake's famous song, "Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright." Ginsberg, Ginsburg, burning bright, taunter of the ultra-right, what blink of the Buddha's eye chose the day for you to die? Queer Pied Piper, howling wild, mantra-minded flower child, queen of Maytime, misrules Lord, bawling, drop out, all aboard, foe of fascist, bane of bomb, finger-symboled, chanting, proper poet's thorn inside, turner of a whole time's tide, who can fill your sloppy shoes? What a catch for death. We lose glee and sweetness, freaky light, Ginsburg, Ginsburg, burning bright. This one's called A Curse on a Thief. It's a curious thing. I have a nephew named Paul, who's an avid fisherman. One day he went to Fox Lake, Wisconsin, and left his beloved tackle box on the dock. And when he came back, it was gone. Someone had ripped it off. Now, Paul is a pious Christian gentleman, and he would never curse the thief who took his tackle box. He told me, actually, that when he found his tackle box missing, he got down and prayed for the thief who had taken it. Now, that takes a big heart. So Paul would never have cursed the thief, so I had to do it for him. I was inspired by some of the classic cursing poems written in the Middle Ages by Scottish, Irish, and Welsh bards. There's a tradition in Scottish medieval verse called flighting, cursing an enemy. And the Druids were poets in ancient Celtic times, the guys who built Stonehenge. It was said that a Druid poet could curse you in rhyme in such a way that he could flay the skin from your back at 40 yards just by the power of his words. Well, I don't think this will do that to the thief. I hope it won't. But anyway, here is A Curse on a Thief. Paul Dempster had a handsome tackle box in which he'd stored up gems for 20 years. Hooks marvelously sharp, ingenious lures, jointed to look alive. He went to Fox Lake, placed it on his dock, went in and poured himself a frosty Coors, returned to find some craven sneak had stolen in behind his back and crooked his entire treasure hoard. Bad cess upon the bastard, may the bass he catches with Paul Dempster's pilfered gear jump from his creel, make haste for his bare rear, and fins out thrust, slide up his underpass. May each ill-gotten catfish in his pan sizzle his lips and peel away the skin. May every perch his pilfered lines reel in, oblige him to spend decades on the can. May he be made to munch a pickerel raw, its steely gaze fixed on him as he chews, choking on every bite, while metal screws inexorably lock his lower jaw, and, having eaten, may he be transformed into a trout himself, with gills and scales, a stupid gasper that a hook impales. In hell's hot griddle may he be well warmed and served with shots of lava on the rocks, to shrieking imps indifferent to his moans, who'll rend his flesh and pick apart his bones. Poor fish who hooked Paul Dempster's tackle box. This is a very short poem from The Lords of Misrule. called On Song. I have always liked song and poetry. Poetry began to be sung or chanted, as far as we know. And I think it's too bad that this tradition has become obscured. On Song. How odd that verse, that song, should so displease the young. They are so serious. They hate all artifice as standing in the way of mind's insistent say. But to my mind, what counts is language that surmounts the message it must bear, steps back without a care, and stone blind yields the day to bloodstream's reckless play. Here is a poem dedicated to the late poet Edgar Bowers, a good friend, a splendid poet. It's called Maples in January, and it just talks about the ability to last, to endure, to persevere, to keep going, to keep putting out leaves. How Edgar Bowers did in his pretty long life, putting out not leaves but poems. And so here's Maples in January. By gust and gale brought down to this simplicity, they stand unleaved and momentarily reprieved from preening photosynthesis, abandoned tons of greenery. As though scorched bare by forest fire, they've shrugged the rustle of desire, the chore of being scenery. And now, impervious to thirst, no longer thrall to summer's sway, they stand their ground as if to say, winter and wind, come do your worst. I was trying to make this point talking to an audience here at the Sewanee Writers Conference the other day. Many young poets in the audience who get discouraged. They send out their poems to magazines, you know, and they get them bounced back with printed slips. And it takes a lot of guts to keep licking those stamps and sending those poems out. It takes endurance to keep on writing. I think all poets, even the oldest and supposedly best established, have to face many disappointments. So if, like Edgar Bowers, you can stand out there and take it and keep going on and keep blooming, that's the way to go. After September 11th, the day after, I wrote a poem called September 12th, 2001. Many of us wrote poems on that colossal occasion. This one doesn't wax grand, I don't believe. It's just a personal account of what I saw on television, as most of us did, of what I felt, and how the next day I felt selfishly grateful that I had not flown on that fateful flight to Los Angeles from Boston's Logan Airport. I had taken that flight in the past, and here I was lying in bed next to my wife. I'd get up, I'd drink coffee, and somehow every second of the new day seemed rendered more valuable by the fact that this terrible event had driven home to us that life is short, that none of us knows when we will die, and that every moment we are alive is like a precious gift. September 12th, 2001. Two caught on film who hurtle from the 82nd floor, choosing between a fireball and to jump, holding hands, aren't us. I wake beside you, stretch, scratch, taste the air, the incredible joy of coffee and the morning light. Alive, we open eyelids to our pitiful share of time. We bubbles, rising and bursting in a boiling pot. Well, lest this reading get too dismal, I'd like to read you some poems I've written for children. I've been doing this now for a long time. Actually, I've been writing poems for kids since before I was married and had kids myself. I think I was inspired by the example of so many poets when I grew up who were writing a good verse for kids. William J. Smith and Randall Jarrell, John Chardy and Phyllis McGinley and many, many more. And I thought, gosh, what fun to write for kids. So I wrote a couple of poems for kids, and I didn't know what you did with them. So I put them in that first book for adults, Nude Descending a Staircase. They came to the attention of a poet and anthologist for children, a great woman named Myra Cohn Livingston. And Myra put one of these little poems in one of her anthologies. Oh, I can read you the little poem. It's called King Tut. It's just a memory of the Egyptian king when he was a boy. As if I could have that memory. King Tut crossed over the Nile on stepping stones of crocodile.
King Tut,
his mother said,
come here this minute. You'll get wet feet.
King Tut is dead. And now King Tut, tight as a nut, keeps his big fat mummy shut. King Tut, tut, tut. Well, Myra Livingston wrote me and said, have you got any more poems for kids? So I sent her the few little things I had, and bless her heart, she showed them to a great children's book editor, Margaret K. McElderry. And Margaret McElderry liked them. I've been the luckiest bastard all my life. And she wrote to me and she said, do you have enough to make a whole collection for kids? Well, I didn't. I wrote back and said, well, I don't right now, but if you mean it, I'll write some more and see if I can come up with one. Well, you know, this was world-shaking to be a poet and have an editor write to you and say, may I have a book of poems from you?
Ah, sure.
This never happens. So the first book was called One Winter Night in August, which Margaret published in 1975. And then I was off to the tune of Hi-Ho Silver. At that moment, rhyme and meter were in the doghouse. You sent a sonnet to a magazine, and wow, it bounced back like a boomerang. So I was feeling rather depressed about how rhyme and meter were doing. But then I got invited to go into schools and share poems with grade school kids. And I found that they had no prejudice against rhyme or a bouncy beat. In fact, they liked such things. So naturally, I liked them. I went on, I wrote many more collections for kids. The nonsensical ones are mostly all collected in a book called Exploding Gravy. Exploding Gravy, it's around. So let me read you a little bit more from it. A poem for kids doesn't necessarily have to have a profound meaning. It shouldn't wax philosophical. Here is a poem with virtually no meaning at all. You know how kids like to imagine recipes for awful food. And I remember I was a counselor at a summer camp, and the kids came out with awful recipes they made up. Snake's guts and bird's eyes and all that. Anyway, this is a recipe for a souffle made out of snow. It's called Snowflake Souffle. And about all it does is get a rhythm going. Snowflake Souffle. Snowflake Souffle makes a lip-smacking lunch on an ice-cold day. You take 7 snowflakes, you break 7 eggs, and you stir it 7 times with your 2 hind legs. Bake it in an igloo, throw it on a plate, and you slice off a slice with a rusty ice skate. Snowflake Souffle is going to be the title of a book coming out sometime soon called Snowflake Souffle, Children Pick Their Favorite Poems of Me. And they really did this. They took a poll of about 150 schools where teachers asked the kids, which of these poems do you like? And they sent in their choices. And that's what the book is made out of. Another one for kids, a very, very short one, is called Mother's Nerves. A small boy is talking. It's just 4 lines long. My mother said,
"If just once more I hear you slam that old screen door, I'll tear out my hair, I'll dive in the stove."
So I gave it a bang, and in she dove. Let me read you one I still kind of like from Exploding Gravy. This is called What We Might Be, What We Are. I read this a while ago to a fourth grade class at a grade school in Cambridge, Mass. And when I told them that this was a love poem, all the boys in the class went, "Oh, you good, P.U. stinks, a love poem." And the girls looked mildly interested. So I hastened to explain that this is about a love affair between two creatures who couldn't possibly be lovers. And at the end of the poem, you find out what the speaker and his loved one really are. What we might be, what we are. If you were a scoop of vanilla, and I were the cone where you sat, if you were a slowly pitched baseball, and I were the swing of a bat, if you were a shiny new fishhook, and I were a bucket of worms, if we were a pin and a pincushion, then we might be on intimate terms. If you were a plate of spaghetti, and I were your piping hot sauce, we'd not even need to write letters to put our affection across. But you're just a piece of red ribbon in the beard of a Balinese goat, and I'm a New Jersey mosquito. I guess we'll stay slightly remote. I've had a lot of fun writing a series of short poems called Brats, usually 4 lines long, about nasty brats who get their comeuppances. And I'll read you just a sample of these. They came out in 3 collections, all now out of print. Brats, Fresh Brats, and Drathy's Brats. And I guess that's all the brats the world wants from me. Anyway, here's one about a brat named John. John, while swimming in the ocean, rubbed sharks' backs with suntan lotion. Now those sharks have skin of bronze in their bellies, namely John's. This is about a brat named Fritz. Stealing eggs, Fritz ran afoul of an angry great horned owl. Now she has him. What a catch, seeing if his head will hatch. This is about a a brat named Doris Drummond who messed with black magic. Doris Drummond sneaked a look in a locked and cobwebbed book, found some secret words, you said, that could summon up the dead. Sad to say, the dead she summoned had it in for Doris Drummond. That's my closest approach to a Stephen King story. Here's one about a brat named Vince. Vince released a jar of vermin during Mr. Drowser's sermon on how cheerfulness is catching. Soon the whole next pew was scratching. Then, oh, here's one that wasn't in any of the published children's books. I put it in the Bratz book, and Margaret McElderry said, why, Joe, this is too awful. I'm afraid it just is too much for children. And I figured she knew what she was talking about, so I didn't put it in a kid's book. But let me confide it to you. It's about a brat named Filbert who messed with the cold cut slicer at the delicatessen. At the market, Filbert Spicer peered into the cold-cut slicer. Whiz! That wicked slicer sped back and forth across his head, quickly shaving. What a shock! 50 chips off Phil's old block, stopping just above the eyebrows. Phil's not one of them thar eyebrows. Well, enough of that. I'd like to give you a little bit of song. Please be warned, I am not a singer. I have a sort of whiskey bass. But I sing my own stuff. I try to so that it does get sung as it's meant to. I believe that if you write in these old-fangled, tight-assed forms, a meter and rhyme, to write songs is one of the things you still can do. And as you know, writers of pop songs have never given up on rhyme. They still use it. People still enjoy it. And, of course, the rap poets have experimented with wild new uses of rhyme, and some of them are just crazy. I love some of them. So anyway, I still stick most of the time to the old forms, but not always. Once in a while, I'm tempted to write in free verse when rhymes just seems too much of a jingle jangle, as in that September 12th poem. Well, anyway, this is an old ballad called In a Prominent Bar in Secaucus One Day. Secaucus, New Jersey, was the place where New York City's garbage used to be cremated. And there was a huge pig farm there that ate some of the garbage. So Secaucus had air pollution before the rest of the country. I used to commute to New York City to go to Columbia, and on warm days, when the commuters were on this train, they had all the windows open. But when the train passed through Secaucus, to a man, they would rush over and slam the windows shut. Anyway, I just picked Secaucus as a locale for this ballad, which is sung by an aging woman who is a junkie and an alcoholic. She's been walking the streets to support her habits, and her mind is beginning to go so that she imagines a beautiful past that never was. In the end of her song, she turns to the young women present in the bar, and she gives them some hard-won advice in the only rude language she knows. Now, I didn't know when I wrote this thing that it was a song, but a young poet, young at the time, Claire McAllister, said, "Why, Joe, I can sing this to the tune of Sweet Betsy from Pike, that Western folk ballad, or the tune of the old Orange Flute, that North of Ireland Protestant comic song." The two tunes are about the same. So I've been trying to sing it ever since. The first stanza and the last stanza are some other voice. Everything in between is this old gal's song in a prominent bar in Secaucus one day. In a prominent bar in Secaucus one day, rose a lady in skunk with a top-heavy sway, raised a knobby red finger, all turned from their beer, while with eyes bright as snow crust, she sang high and clear. Now who of you'd think, from an eye load of me, that I once was a lady as proud as could be? Oh, I'd never sit down by a tumble-down drunk if it wasn't me dears for the high cost of junk. All the gents used to swear that the white of me calf beat the down of the swan by a length and a half. In the kerchief of linen I caught to me nose, ah, there never fell snot, just a little gold rose. I had 7 gold teeth and a toothpick of gold. Me Virginia cheroot was a leaf of it rolled, and I'd light it each time with 1,000 in cash. Ah, the bums used to fight if I flicked them an ash. Once the toast of the Biltmore, the bell of the Taft, I would drink bottled beer at the Drake, never draft, and dine at the Astor on Salisbury steak, with a clean tablecloth for each bite I did take. In a car like the Roxy I'd roll to the track, with a steel guitar trio and a bar in the back, and the wheels made no noise, they turned over so fast, still it took you 10 minutes to see me go past. And when the horses bowed down to me that I might choose, I bet on them all, for I hated to lose. Now I'm saddled each night for me butter and eggs, and the broken threads race down the backs of me legs. Let you hold in mind, girls, that your beauty must pass like a lovely white clover that rusts with its grass. Keep your bottoms off bar stools and marry you young, or be left an old barrel with many a bung. For when time takes you out for a spin in his car, you'll be hard-pressed to stop him from going too far, and be left by the roadside for all your good deeds. 2 toadstools for tits and a face full of weeds. All the house raised a cheer, but the man at the bar made a phone call and up pulled a red patrol car. And she blew us a kiss as they copped her away from that prominent bar in Secaucus, NJ.
Joe, thank you so much. That was absolutely delightful. Thank you for being a guest on the show. And listeners, this is a rare opportunity to hear one of our country's finest poets. And the first time I've never asked a question. Thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you, Casey.